nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station, broadcasting from Kodiak, Alaska, where it's 54 degrees out at the airport right now. We're still looking at a 40% chance of rain today. Mostly cloudy skies today with a high near 57, west winds to 5, becoming completely calm this afternoon. For tonight, a 50% chance of rain, mainly before 1 a.m. Mostly cloudy skies overnight with a low around 48 and calm winds. And for Thursday, again a 40% chance of rain, mainly after 1, mostly cloudy, high near 55, east wind to 5, becoming calm, so just like today it sounds like. For Friday, they're calling for just plain rain, mainly after 7 a.m., southeast winds to 25, gusting as high as 35 on Friday. Coming up on the Midday Report, firefighters near the Chena Hot Springs Resort are battling that blaze. The Coast Guard has reached a major milestone with regard to COVID-19 vaccinations. It's unclear where to go from here. And a Homer nonprofit would like to improve Alaskans' food security. After NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Another agonizing day for rescuers and the families of those feared trapped beneath the rubble of a partially collapsed condo building in Florida. Miami-Dade County Mayor Danielle Levine-Cava confirms 10 more bodies have been recovered, raising the confirmed death toll to 46.
Every single victim uncovered is somebody's child, somebody's mother, somebody's teacher, somebody's colleague, a classmate, a best friend.
More than 90 people are still unaccounted for in Surfside. The U.S. and other governments are expressing shock over the assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. Local security forces say unidentified attackers killed the leader in his private residence after midnight. His wife was wounded. Haiti is now under a state of emergency. The U.S. embassy is closed. President Biden today condemned the attack.
We need a lot more information, but it's very worrisome about the state of Haiti.
Biden speaking to reporters as he was about to travel to Illinois. As the world's first black-led republic and the second independent republic in the Western Hemisphere after the U.S., Haiti has confronted a long history of foreign intervention, economic crises, natural disasters, and political instability. A federal judge in Texas says the Air Force is 60% responsible for the November 2017 Sutherland Springs mass shooting that claimed 26 lives. The ruling is a step toward determining what damages are owed to the victims' families. Texas Public Radio's Paul Flav has more.
Judge Xavier Rodriguez found that the government failed to exercise reasonable care in submitting shooter and former airman Devin Kelly's criminal history to the FBI. That failure increased the risk to the general public. Families of the victims killed at First Baptist Church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, sued the government, arguing Kelly's military criminal history would have barred him from owning the weapons he used in the killing, had the Air Force turned it over. Judge Rodriguez agreed, saying no other individual, not even Kelly's own parents or partner, knew as much as the United States about the threat Kelly posed. I'm Paul Flav in San Antonio.
The White House is embarking on a new strategy to get COVID-19 shots in the arms of more people in the U.S., especially now. The CDC confirms more contagious Delta variant accounts for more than half of all new infections. The unvaccinated, most at risk of getting sick or possibly dying from COVID. But NPR's Rob Stein points to new data from Israel raising concerns about the ability of vaccines to fight the latest variant.
The Israeli Ministry of Health issued a brief statement that says the power of the Pfizer vaccine to protect people from getting infected or getting mildly or moderately ill has dropped over the last month as the Delta virus has taken over in that country from somewhere in the 90s to just 64%. So that would clearly raise concerns about that vaccine and the Moderna vaccine, which is very similar.
This is NPR.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
Firefighters remain focused on protecting Chena Hot Springs Resort and area cabins from the Munson Creek wildfire. The 24,000-acre lightning-caused blaze about 50 miles east of Fairbanks made it to the resort property overnight, but as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, firefighters were well prepared.
The Munson Creek fire is burning primarily in a remote, limited protection area, but worked its way from a ridge to Chena Hot Springs Resort over the long holiday weekend. State Forestry spokesperson Tim Mowry says firefighters are able to engage the slow-moving flames.
There's three fingers of the fire that are sort of coming down that hillside. It's not a big wall of flames or anything like that. The closest it got was about within 100 yards behind the resort. We've got firefighters positioned there to stop it, and they've been successful doing that.
A system of water pumps, hoses, and sprinklers are set up around resort structures, as well as dozens of private cabins and homes outside the resort along the last 8 miles of Chena Hot Springs Road, where an evacuation order remains in effect.
Closest it is to any to the road or, you know, those cabins along the road on the south side is about 1 mile. So it's still a little distance from the road. Firefighters continue to set up structure protection around more cabins as they move farther down the road toward 48 mile.
Mowry says cooler, cloudier weather is giving firefighters time to complete that work. It's unclear how many people have actually evacuated as Chena Hot Springs Resort remains open.
We're safer here than any place else.
Bernie Carl is president of Chena Holdings, the holding company for the employee-owned Chena Hot Springs Resort. Carl says the resort has a wildfire response plan and equipment.
Fire trucks, dozers, loaders, equipment all here ready to fight the fire.
No structures have been lost, but Carl says about 1,500 acres of resort property had burned as of Monday and that staff were moved from employee housing on the outskirts of the resort.
The fire was close to the employee housing, so we put sprinklers all around the area and we moved them into the hotel because that was a much safer area. And we moved our horses out of a paddock and moved them into a corral that's 5 acres fenced in closer to the resort.
Carl emphasizes that the resort is operating and new guests continue to arrive. The decision to stay open and not evacuate has drawn local criticism. Forestry's Mowry says no one can be forced to leave, but underscores that staying in the fire zone puts firefighters at additional risk.
If they have to worry about saving people that did not evacuate, it just takes their focus away from what they're trying to accomplish.
Mowry says another crew is expected to arrive today and will increase the number of firefighters on the Munson Creek blaze to about 175. With help from KUAC's Robin and Dan Bross in Fairbanks.
The Coast Guard has reached a major milestone in the fight against COVID-19, according to a recent article in the MyCG website. The article states that the Coast Guard has fully vaccinated against COVID-19 71.8% of its active duty workforce. If you include reserve members, the Coast Guard has a 69.2% vaccination rate, with 71.5% with at least one dose. The article also states, quote, "The Coast Guard is building on this milestone to fully vaccinate 100% of its total workforce," end quote. It's unclear how this milestone will be reached. At present, the Coast Guard is not mandating that members get the vaccine. A recent article of the Army Times states that the Army has directed commands to prepare to administer mandatory COVID-19 vaccines. It's unclear if the Coast Guard will do the same. According to the Q&A section of the Coast Guard's website's COVID-19 information page, in response to the question, will the Coast Guard require all service members to receive the vaccine, the response reads, quote, "Currently, the vaccine is offered on a voluntary basis. Priority populations are encouraged highly to receive the vaccine. When formally licensed by the Food and Drug Administration, a vaccine may become mandatory for military personnel, as is the case for the influenza vaccine." Alternately, if the White House issues an order mandating vaccination for members of the armed forces, the vaccine may become required as a matter of policy, end quote. The COVID-19 pandemic has interrupted just about everything, including food shipments to grocery stores all over Alaska. Last year, Alaskans really felt it, with some products just not available. A Homer-based nonprofit is advocating changes that could improve food security in the state food system. KDLL's Elizabeth Earle has more.
Alaska depends on shipments for about 95% of its food, which makes the state fragile when those supply lines are interrupted. Reportedly, interest in local food has grown during the pandemic as well. Good news for the Kenai Peninsula, which was home to more than 250 farms in 2017, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Farmers and local food advocates have stood on that fact to push for more in-state food production support and infrastructure, and with the pandemic highlighting food insecurity, they are taking the opportunity to push for broader changes. The Alaska Food Policy Council, a Homer-based nonprofit that advocates for improvements in the state food system, issued a set of recommendations for improving food security in the state at the end of June. Key to the recommendations are the funds coming through the American Rescue Plan Act, a major aid package meant to help mitigate the impacts of the pandemic. Food insecurity spiked during the pandemic as people lost their jobs. Kara Durr, the Director of Public Engagement for the Food Bank of Alaska, says the pandemic made food insecurity suddenly a very real topic of conversation. Durr is also on the board of the Alaska Food Policy Council.
It became a very, very visible outcome of the pandemic, you know, with food insecurity rates really dramatically rising. So I think it's one of the really positive things to come out of the pandemic is that I think there's just been so much great discussion and awareness that, you know, food is everything, and we need to make sure that we have a strong food system that, you know, supports our state, supports our growers, supports our low-income Alaskans.
Food insecurity doesn't just necessarily mean a lack of food. It can also mean nutritionally poor foods. Fresh foods tend to be more expensive, particularly in rural areas of Alaska away from Anchorage or other urban centers. That can mean that families in need may make compromises on the health of what they're buying, Durr says. One of the recommendations from the Food Policy Council is to invest in cold storage, particularly in rural areas. Expanding infrastructure like cold storage would allow for more fresh produce to make it to areas that may not have access to it now. For example, the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank purchased a refrigerated truck last year, which allowed it to take perishables like fresh milk to more remote communities. Another recommendation is to invest in local food purchasing programs, where the state would provide funds to food banks to purchase locally produced food and distribute it. The Food Bank of Alaska participates in something like this now, but not formally, Durr says. She says it doesn't have to take a particular form, but there seems to be support for it.
The feedback we've been hearing is that there is a strong interest in finding ways to support local growers, local producers, and there's a strong desire to make sure that people are adequately fed. You know, certainly we've seen just really high levels of hunger during the pandemic. And so this is a program that I think is kind of hitting that sweet spot of satisfying both of those goals.
Other recommendations include investments in food system workforce development, transportation, improvements to importing livestock, in-state poultry production, and kitchen, manufacturing, and processing facilities. All are linked to the funding that could come to Alaska from the American Rescue Plan funds. Durr says the legislature has shown support for food system improvements. In 2021 so far, food insecurity has actually declined as well, according to national food security nonprofit Feeding America. However, Durr says that's a reflection of how much the federal aid packages being injected into communities helped. You can see more about the Alaska Food Policy Council's recommendations on their website, akfoodpolicycouncil.org. We have a link to it on our website. For KDLL, I'm Elizabeth Earle.
Reborn Airline Raven Alaska has hired several people to study a new Trans-Pacific service that its chief executive says could launch as soon as next summer. Rob McKinney says the company, which right now operates solely inside Alaska, would fly between Asian hubs and destinations in the lower 48, with stops in Anchorage for passengers to clear customs. McKinney says that by using smaller jets, those that have a single aisle, the flights could be sold more cheaply than existing airlines that use larger planes. And even if they're not nonstop, McKinney says they could still attract enough customers to schedule year-round daily service.
The planes that we operate, we think we can do it more cost-effective, so we might have a better price point. We also think the process of clearing customs and immigration in Alaska would be far superior and less painful than some of the more busy airports in the lower 48.
McKinney says Raven has hired three or four people who are working full-time on developing the company's plans, although they're far from solid. He says Raven is looking at several options to raise the money needed to launch the service, but he isn't releasing any details. While Raven's initial plans would be geared toward travelers between the lower 48 and Asian cities like Tokyo and Seoul, McKinney says that ultimately he sees potential in making Anchorage a tourist stopover, like Iceland often is for people flying between the U.S. and Europe.
Instead of connecting across a couple hours, you connect across a couple days, and then you get to go dog sledding or salmon fishing or you know, all these wonderful things you can do here.
Raven currently operates 11 planes between Anchorage and rural hub communities. Its current majority owner is a family trust of California entrepreneur and Bitcoin investor Josh Jones. The company emerged from bankruptcy last year after COVID-19 hammered its revenue, and McKinney says it returned to profitability this spring. Raven says it's confident it could launch the new service without taking on what McKinney calls excessive debt, which sank the previous incarnation of the company. McKinney says Raven hopes its new service could fly out of the underused North Terminal at Anchorage's International Airport. Officials there say they haven't received a detailed proposal from Raven, but are ready to support the company's operations if and when they take off. Governor Mike Dunleavy said he was going to veto a $4 billion transfer within the Alaska Permanent Fund. The money would go from the Permanent Fund's earnings reserve to the fund's principal, the part protected under the Alaska Constitution. But as Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman reports, his office made a $4 billion error by failing to cross out a few lines.
The budget that the legislature passed and sent to Governor Dunleavy's desk would make a deposit of $4 billion into the constitutionally protected permanent fund. That's almost as much as the state spends of its own money to operate all of state government. Dunleavy signed the budget bill last Wednesday, but before he did that, he made his line item vetoes, things he wants to cross out from the budget. He thought he had crossed out a big one.
There was a decision by the legislature to move billions of dollars from the earnings reserve of the permanent fund into the corpus of the permanent fund. We stopped that from happening with a veto.
Dunleavy explained why he wanted to veto the money on Thursday. He said he wants to work with the legislature on a comprehensive approach to the permanent fund, including the money in the earnings reserve. The only problem can be found on page 138 of the budget bill. That's the page that deals with the permanent fund. There's a line about paying for administrative costs. Much of it is crossed out, vetoed. Another line that would pay for $525 permanent fund dividends. Crossed out, vetoed. And a line about the $4 billion transfer to the corpus? Not crossed out, so not vetoed. Legislators became aware of the issue late last week. Dunleavy tried to correct the error. He told Senate President Peter Michicki and House Speaker Louise Stutes that he intended to veto the transfer. But legislative staff weren't prepared to make the change he was asking for. On Tuesday, the governor's office said he will allow the transfer to go through, despite his intention to veto it. It means that with the stroke of a pen, or in this case, the lack of one, the amount of permanent fund money that's protected under the state constitution rose from just under $48 billion to nearly $52 billion. But that still leaves nearly $30 billion that is either in the earnings reserve or is locked up in investment gains like real estate that haven't been realized yet. On August 2nd, the legislature is scheduled to convene for the third special session this year. The governor has proposed a constitutional amendment that would protect the remaining amount in the earnings reserve. It also would put the permanent fund dividend in the Constitution. The size of PFDs that Dunleavy is proposing would be based on half of the amount drawn from the fund annually. Currently, that would lead to a dividend of roughly $2,350. But nonpartisan budget analysts estimate it would create annual deficits averaging $1 billion this decade without other changes to policy. Members of both legislative majorities praised the transfer. Sitka Republican Senator Bert Stedman helped develop the proposal as co-chair of the Senate Finance Committee. He'd like to look at protecting more of the permanent fund.
My concern is the legislature will walk through the earnings reserve like a knife through hot butter. And we need to protect it for current and future generations.
An Anchorage Democratic representative, Ivy Sponholz, said it was critical to protect the $4 billion that was transferred, considering the history of spending from savings.
I think in the end, it came out the way that it needed to come out, which is ensuring that another $4 billion is protected in the corpus of the permanent fund.
A spokesperson for Dunleavy said the $4 billion transfer won't adversely affect his permanent fund proposal, which would, quote, guarantee Alaskans receive their share of the state's resource wealth each year and end the annual debate over the amount of the PFD, end quote. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
Today's KMXT local news is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Norton Sound tests the waters for a pink salmon fishery. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
A small fleet of Norton Sound purse seiners will test the waters for a new pink salmon fishery this summer. Pink returns to the region's rivers have skyrocketed in recent years to well over 10 million fish. It will be a first experiment for Seine Gear and Humpies so far north. For the pink salmon, fish managers say it's all about the food.
They're definitely the colonizers, for sure. And I've had calls from people on the North Slope asking about pink salmon fisheries up there because pink salmon are showing up there. I don't know that they're going to persist because it still freezes down up there. And so the eggs that are deposited in those rivers won't generally survive if they're frozen. But, you know, they're trying.
Sam Raybung is director of the Commercial Fisheries Division at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. As ocean waters warm, he says it changes the makeup of plankton the pink salmon feed upon. The fish are following their healthier food sources northward.
As the warmer water moves north, the warmer water copepods, which is one of the main foods for salmon, moves north with it. The cold water copepods have a high lipid, high fat content, so they're very energy dense. They have a lot of bang for the buck for eating on them.
Warm water plankton don't. And since salmon are a cold water species, warm waters also boost their metabolism, meaning they need more food to grow. Raybung points to the 2018 Gulf of Alaska cod collapse that science has linked with a preceding multi-year warm water blob. The resulting food imbalance wiped out two cod year classes and prevented cod eggs from hatching. He says a changing ocean brings big challenges, and paying attention to the impacts on fish can help managers better react.
Just knowing what's happening with stocks.
Meanwhile, the changes mean a new pink salmon fishery at Norton Sound. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 14, date issued 9 a.m. on July 5th. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, July 6th, until 9 p.m. Thursday, July 8th in the Inner Aikuluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District. Closed waters will be increased from noon Tuesday, July 6th until 9 p.m. Thursday, July 8th in the Inner Aikuluk section and includes those waters within 500 yards of the stream mouth of Aikuluk River, stream number 256201. As previously announced, there will be an 81-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, July 6th until 9 p.m. Friday, July 9th in the following areas. In the Northwest Kodiak District, except for the Kujuiak Bay section, will remain closed. The Cape Alitak, Humpy Deadman, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District. The Northeast Kodiak District, except for the Buskin River section, will remain closed. The Eastside Kodiak District, except for the Inner Ugak Bay section, will remain closed. And the Afognak District, except for the Duck Bay, Iziut Bay, and Inner and Outer Katoy Bay sections, remain closed. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, July 6th, until 9 p.m. Thursday, July 8th, in the Mainland District. Through 12:01 a.m. July 6th, fishermen are reminded that in the Kodiak area, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. After 12:01 a.m. July 6th until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only those portions of the northwest and southwest Kodiak districts south of a latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length, may not be retained by Per Sangir in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Concerning the North Shelikof Strait fishery, short notice in-period closures may occur for seine fisheries in the seaward zones of the North Shelikof Strait area as designated in the North Shelikof Strait Sockeye Salmon Management Plan. Closure announcements may occur at 8:30 a.m., 10 a.m., noon, 2 p.m., 5 p.m., or 8 p.m. on VHF Channel 6. The following areas are currently open until further notice and will close to commercial salmon fishing at 9 p.m. Friday, July 9th. Fowl Bay Special Harvest Area and the Waterfall Bay Special Harvest Area. Closed water adjustments. Closed waters are currently reduced until 9 p.m. Thursday, July 9th, in Fowl Bay to the stream terminus at Hidden Lake Creek, stream number 251406, and in Waterfall Bay to the stream terminus at Little Waterfall Creek, stream number 251822, and to the stream terminus at Big Waterfall Creek, stream number 251821. Following areas remain open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice: the outer Aikuluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District and the inner and outer Upper Station sections of the Alitak District. Closed waters are currently reduced until further notice in the inner Upper Station section of the Alitak District, and the waters will remain open to the stream terminus of Olga Creek, stream number 257301. Cost recovery fisheries have begun in Spearin Bay Special Harvest Area, also known as Telrod Cove, and the Spearin Bay Special Harvest Area will remain closed to common property fishing. Fishing opportunities will depend on the ability of KRAA cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart, detailed in Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations, and statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 7th day of July, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 5:20. It won't set again until 11:07, giving us 17 hours and 47 minutes of glorious daylight, a loss of 2 minutes and 16 seconds compared to yesterday. The record high for this date was 78. That was set in 1984. The record low is 39, set in 1982. We're right between that at 55 degrees. And we've been under the threat of 40% chance of rain. I guess that means it's 60% chance of no rain. Mostly cloudy skies today, high near 57, west winds to 5, becoming calm. For tonight, a 50% chance of rain, mainly before 2 a.m. Mostly cloudy skies overnight with a low of 48. And for tomorrow, the exact same weather as today, 40% chance of rain, mainly after 2 p.m. Mostly cloudy skies, high near 55. But for tomorrow, it'll be east wind, 5 miles per hour, becoming calm. We have a high tide coming up here on the east side that will happen at 2:11 p.m. and be 6 feet, followed by a low tide at 6:55 of 3.2 feet. Over on the west side, and this is Zacher Bay tide, your next high tide will be at 2:19 this afternoon and be 11.4 feet. Followed by a low tide at 7:51 p.m. of 4.2 feet. If you're thinking of going out on the water, for Chiniac Bay, we're looking at variable less than 10 right now. Seas building to 3 feet this afternoon. For tomorrow, variable less than 10, turning to the southeast 10, seas to 2 feet. Up in Marmot Bay, west winds to 10 knots, seas to 3 feet. For tomorrow, variable less than 10, becoming east 10, seas to 3 feet. Nominating petitions for 1 2-year city mayor seat and 2 3-year city council seats are now available at the city clerk's office. For more information, call the clerk at 486-8636. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session followed by a regular meeting this coming Thursday. The whole thing starts at 6:30 p.m. and will be held at the library's multi-purpose room.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 3 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org. Thank you.